This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Liliana Gill, a host on the channel, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Dr. Hector Beltran, who is the author of the book Codework, Hacking Across the U.S.-Mexico Techno Borderlands, published by Princeton University Press in 2023. Welcome to the show, Hector. I'm very happy to be talking about your work. To get us started, Hector, it would be great if you could tell us a bit about Codework. How did you come to this project? What made you want to write this book?
Thank you so much for the invitation, Liliana. It's a pleasure and honor to be in conversation with you here. I know we've been in conversation textually through our works, somewhat aligned, similar, but now we get to sort of focus on my book here, thank you, and have this conversation. Great. So since the book is about programming, code work, and you're looking for a sort of origin story here, I'm going to give you three nested origin stories. So the first origin story is about my time as a graduate student, PhD student, UC Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area, since this book is a result of an extension and expansion of a PhD dissertation. So I'm there in the Bay Area, a lot of hype around technology, Silicon Valley, as there usually is, as there usually has been in the last decades. And myself and other students working around the Center for Latino Policy Research found this initiative called Latinos in and Tech. We started to notice disconnections between the way different groups talked about diversity in tech. So yes, diversity in the sense of representation, including more people of color, people from different backgrounds in the tech industry. But we wanted to talk more about the systematic issues underlying why there wasn't enough representation of certain folks in the tech industry. As we started seeing what the community was saying, what the actual tech industry was saying, what academia was saying, because there was differences in academia as well, right? The way ethnic studies talked about this underrepresentation, the way anthropology talks about it, the way computer science talks about it, there was already these disconnections. But one sort of misconnection we saw right away was one between U.S. Latinos and so-called Latin Americans or people from Latin America, the global South more broadly, but Latin America specifically. One example is a conference we were at where they were discussing diversity in tech. So it was a tech conference, but you know, we were happy that there was this diversity in tech panel, you know, representatives from industry, from academia, again, from the community, discussing diversity in terms we might be more familiar with, thinking systematically about it, using terms we might use in academia, thinking critically about diversity, not just in the more representation sense. And then the very next panel was about including people from Latin America in the tech industry. And the diversity discourse seemed to disappear. They turned it into a narrative about meritocracy. And at one point, we even saw, you know, people pitting U.S. Latinos against Latin Americans, saying U.S. Latinos don't have entrepreneurial abilities. They're not taking advantage the way these, you know, respectable Latin Americans are. And for us, it was very clear that there was a class issue here. There were misconnections, but it was quite, you know, in our face because it was one panel after the other. So that's one origin story. You know, so how to investigate this as a researcher? At the same time, there are these hackathons appearing, you know, where people get together and program over the course of a few days, usually a weekend, around some representative theme, healthcare, immigration, inequality, taking on some of the Silicon Valley discourse and technologies, but also thinking critically about other issues in the world. The hackathon itself was also mobile in the sense there were some in the US, there were some in Mexico, there were some circulating between US and Mexico, and I wanted to think transnationally. So I thought the hackathon as an empirical site to do research is what I want to focus my dissertation on. That's the first origin story. Second one is, okay, I want to study hackathons. How do I infiltrate them or become a participant observer in these spaces, especially in Mexico, right? Luckily, there was this call for MIT alum to do a short summer course on mobile technologies in Mexico, first in UNAM one summer, then in Jalapa, Veracruz, further south the next summer. And I thought this is a perfect way for me to come back, check out the moves of these programmers, because a lot of the students were from programming backgrounds, but they were also active in the hackathon scene. So it gave me time to work with them on their coding, also follow them in the hackathon circuit, and even as they constructed these more permanent spaces that I talk about in the book, the hacker school, right? Great. So that sort of gives me the entry into the field. And then the final origin story, which I'm not sure if it's nested inside of it or outside of it, is my own trajectory here, my personal story, shifting from computer science to anthropology. So I studied computer science at MIT in the famous Core 6, for people who are familiar with the MIT lingo. And, you know, when I graduated, I call myself an ambivalent coder. I took on a tech consulting job precisely because I wasn't sure what type of work I wanted to do. They sold it to me as, hey, you get to travel around the world to these exotic places, work on different technologies. I went to very exotic places such as Bentonville, Arkansas. You know, that's the headquarters of a large multinational corporation that starts with W. The same project sent me to Mexico City. And I saw these, they used me for my bicultural, bilingual skills, sort of between the US consultants and the Mexican workers. And I started to see that there was more than technological change, right? It was something about culture, something about socio-cultural, political difference. I wanted to study this more closely, decided to return to the university to do a PhD in anthropology. Longer story, but the short version of that is that I went from ambivalent coder to ambivalent anthropologist, as I say in the book, but always an unwavering code worker, which is the title of the book. And I think this is the ethos I bring to my work and also to my position at MIT, where I teach students who are, you know, majority of them studying computer science, interested in technology, but trying to get them to become what I call border code workers, thinking critically about other domains of life, but still connected to the code, to the technology.
And that links to my second question, which is about code work. Throughout the book, you show us how different characters really learn to navigate the inequalities of the US-Mexico techno-borderlands at these multiple levels. And I was particularly struck by the idea of threshold person. You bring it up in the introduction, and I think it ties beautifully to your final chapter on pivoting. So if you could tell us more about code work and how code work linked to code switching, and they go hand in hand in your book.
Great. So I love this concept of the threshold person. It's an homage here to Ansaldúa, thinking about in-betweenness. I mean, the title of the book, Techno Borderlands, for those familiar with Ansaldúa's work, are going to say, what does a book about programming and code have to do with Ansaldúa? But precisely bringing these type of interventions into the classroom, again, going back to getting folks who are interested in computing, programming, to read something like Gloria Ansaldúa, her genre-breaking book, Borderlands, you know, who brings all these different worlds together, poetry, social analysis, politics. The way her work is sometimes interpreted quite, I guess, superficially is about, hey, she was intersectional identity, right? Oh, yes, sexuality, race, class, you know, multiple identities. That's not really what Ansaldúa's work was reading. There's entire scholars of Ansaldúa and border thinking more broadly who have very elegant ways to analyze and present her work. But I think Threshold Person points to two ideas from her work that we can borrow into the code work. The first one is precisely about commonalities. So it's not just that you're an intersectional person because you belong to different identities, but you see commonalities between different worlds, different ways people move about the world, perhaps because of who they are, perhaps because of their positionality, how they present different aspects of themselves to the world. But it's about moving between worlds. One of my favorite books is Strange Affinities. It's a collection of essays on the gender and sexual politics of comparative racialization, edited by Grace Hong, Roderick Ferguson. So I like this term also, I think closely related here, strange affinities, looking at connections between what might seem like different worlds, which is related to the second concept, this idea of in-betweenness, being a threshold person. Again, from border thinkers like Ansaldúa, what does it mean to inhabit these borders? Pay attention to why they're constructed in the first place. Pay attention to the everyday work it does to construct them, but also the games being played on both sides of these borders. And my proposal for a border code worker is that as you're being very careful with, say, something like the code you're writing, again, you're inhabiting the code worlds, you're bringing parts of yourself to particular ways of writing code, of computer programming, you're being very careful about defining interfaces, about thinking about edge cases in this particular snippet of code. How might you bring that same sort of systematic thinking to thinking about connecting the code worlds to other worlds that you inhabit, your personal life, your political life? So this is the sort of impetus behind thinking about how folks who are immersed in what I call the code worlds might transfer some of these logics, ways of thinking about problems to other domains of their life, be it their personal lives, their political lives, their social, dating, sex lives, as my third chapter in their code work across domains brings in.
Yeah, I was interested in how, you know, the threshold person is also a person that negotiates between different worlds. So it has to do some code switching as well, right? It talked about performance of Latinidad, for instance. I thought, you know, those discussions in your book were quite interesting and they come later. So you open with threshold person, but then you have a discussion about pivoting. And when you talk about pivoting, it's about pivoting towards different projects. As these entrepreneurs, I have to navigate, you know, the requests of Silicon Valley, but it's also pivoting yourself, right? There's an aspect, I think it's Jacko, Javo. There's this character in the final chapter that does a lot of self-pivoting as well. And I thought it was interesting. He's a threshold person in this way and is you know, code switching. And
yeah, thank you. And that final chapter precisely is where a lot of it comes together, right? Performance of self, pivoting across the techno borderlands, thinking about that project specifically. So let's start with one term I use, which is hacker entrepreneur, right? Like, why am I putting those two words together? And precisely as you're saying here, it's about how young people working from Mexico want to be part of Silicon Valley, also have to negotiate all these different parts of themselves and their situations to be part of it, to be critical of it. So, you know, what kind of things do they have to negotiate? The anti-corporate hacking ethos versus the embeddedness and dependence of hackers on industry, tech companies, these hackathons, right? They're using a lot of technologies from these, you know, big tech companies that are also being criticized for some less positive aspects of what they're doing in the world. What else are they negotiating? This focus on autonomy, do it yourself sort of ethos versus the promise of state protection and care. How is the state sort of helping me advance my project? What do I demand of the state? What else are they negotiating? The desired association between these Mexican hackers and the Silicon Valley tech scene. versus the reality of being exploited by it in some sense. A lot of them are contractors. A lot of them work by the job. A lot of them work for, and they're quite conscious of this, less money than their colleagues in the US might be getting paid, even if they're doing the same work, even if they're doing better work, even if they're doing more work. What else are they negotiating? Their diverse personal, professional aspirations versus the limited opportunities perhaps available in Mexico. And, you know, also these negotiations between their differing positions on migration, mobility, versus staying and working for your country, right? There's all these terms that are thrown out, brain drain, sort of your talent, sort of leaving the country. So there's different ways to think about that. These are things they have to negotiate. And holding this in analysis means seeing how they themselves negotiate these tensions, right? So I think this last story you're pointing to brings a lot of this together beautifully, because Javo and his colleagues are in Mexico. They're social justice-minded folks, let's say, for the moment. They're thinking about how to end fraud elections, so how to have better elections in Mexico. It's common that you see, you know, all kinds of corruptness. I'm not saying this is specific to Mexico, but, you know, things like getting people to vote for someone by paying them, you know, busing them to different locations to play with the numbers, to get particular candidates to win in elections, et cetera. So they develop a Twitter platform so that people can communicate and point to where this kind of corruption is going on the day of elections. They're interested in these kind of interventions. They're also very interested in programming, technology. You know, the chapter tells a complete story, but they end up going to Silicon Valley or attending these boot camps that call for people from Latin America to participate in the Silicon Valley scene, perhaps for funding. They get the attention of investors, but they pivot their idea to a pizza delivery platform, right? So from politics to pizza.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Something completely distorted from their original idea. But they're told to focus on the technology. You know, this is how you generate revenue. Down the line, as they're working on their technologies, they're on something called the startup bus. They're unable to get a good Wi-Fi connection. They start working on a tool to communicate from phone to phone without a Wi-Fi internet connection. They start looking into mesh networking, how to communicate using mesh networking from phone to phone. They also use it during a Mexico City earthquake. The technology is so good, their solution is so sophisticated, that it gets the attention of other apps, other companies who want to use it. They end up getting a good amount of investment from venture capitalists in Silicon Valley to work on this technology. And down the line, this peer-to-peer mesh networking communication platform ends up being used in protests in Hong Kong, Ukraine, Myanmar. So it does actually come back to their sort of social justice, more politically inflected ethos, perhaps, in some strange way, right? Because it goes through the Silicon Valley pivots, this idea that you need to pivot your company to align with the market, a term that comes from a popular book, The Lean Startup. So there's a lot to think about here. Like, why did this happen? And in the argument I'm pushing is, how's their code work related to this? What is about the programming that perhaps made them go to these fundamental layers of the programming? Does it help them as they're thinking about their situation? And the argument I unfold with this chapter, with other chapters in the book, is that there is some power in the code. There is some fundamental way of thinking about interfaces, the way perhaps different components of your system present themselves to each other, that also parallels the way you present yourself in different domains of life, especially as they're trying to get investment from Silicon Valley. They present certain parts of themselves to different people. They learn what it takes to navigate the complex politics of meritocracy, of racism, classism, etc. And even if they are the privileged folks, the few privileged folks who are able to circulate and go to Silicon Valley, they also return to Mexico and teach some of this to other folks in Mexico, which is one of the main things I want to show across the book.
Excellent. And I think you did that so well, of like staying with this ambiguous back and forth between social justice and a more entrepreneurial drive amongst these people. And I think, yeah, the book really, really shows that. I had another question about humor. I know this is not a central topic in Code Work, but I was very interested in the role of humor in the realities you describe. I think humor is always present throughout the book. And for instance, you have that stuff on banter and becoming Chingon as a performance of masculinity in chapter 2, and a discussion on sexuality in chapter 3 that I thought was very amusing as well. Daniela Rivero's artwork, which is excellent, also matches that, you know, tongue-in-cheek tone. Would you like to say a few words about, you know, humor, how it appeared in your fieldwork? How do you see it in the book?
Great. Thanks for recognizing that, because it's something I thought quite consciously about, and the work by artist Daniela Rivero's illustrations as well, which is a type of hacking in itself. I hope that the readers enjoy the visual representations of some of the ethnographic scenes and the humor that we worked very hard on expressing. So I'm not the first person to notice that programmers, I'm gonna say, they're very interested in humor. Humor is a large part of their lives. Biela Coleman in Coding Freedom, who you might say is the, you know, first book that thinks about coding and programmers and their life worlds, very explicitly brings this dimension of humor into the book and calls attention to the fact that programmers are very interested in presenting themselves as funny, as calling attention to absurdities and form, the absurdities of life as things that are humorous, calling attention to the moments where particular systems break down and are funny to or humorous to different folks. So I wanted to bring in the humor dimension of my characters for what one simple reason also is our role as ethnographers. Now, some of my favorite ethnographies are ones where, even if we're talking about something serious, and you might think, how serious is this book about programming? As I lay out in my introduction, at the same time that this is going on, you know, there's disappeared students in Mexico, the Ayotzinapa case, not irrelevant, not disconnected from what's going on in hackathons. You know, some people have their hacking valued, some people have their hacking undervalued. It's a matter of life and death. So there's something serious about the ethnography here, if that's lost on anyone. But my favorite ethnographies, even if they're thinking about something serious, bring complete characters to the work. Not just thinking about politics, not just thinking about something that is brought into focus with the analysis, but thinking about complete characters. Some examples, Tom Belstorff's Coming of Age in Second Life, Lawrence Ralph's Renegade Dreams, thinking about gang life. They're able to subtly incorporate this humor into their writing, which I was a big fan of. So my solution to this is including these character profiles as well. This cast of code workers that's in one of my appendices. So I'll give the example of one profile I include here, Hiro, who is one of the characters who shows up across the book, who's hacking the dating scene in San Francisco goes wrong. I'll leave that as a teaser so you could read more about it in the book. So now I gave these profiles. He's into the SF dating scene. He's in his late 20s. He's a hardware engineer. He's born in Mexico to Guatemalan father, Japanese mother. He's fluent in English and sign language. He's the well-liked entrepreneurial lead in the MIT coding bootcamp at UNAM. And the final thing I leave here is he leaves his framed photograph in Airbnb rentals. So this is when Airbnb is taking off in the mid 2010s, and his sort of hack there, someone's welcoming you into their home. This is your home, is leaving his framed photograph. And I take this as some sort of attention to the absurdity of hosting someone, leaving you. Obviously they're going to take it down because it's not really your house, but this sort of ethos of hacking, calling attention to the absurdity of situations, something that's very present in my research participant, that's something I wanted to bring to the book.
It makes the book really lively as well, and it's good to read. To finish our conversation, now that the book is out there in the world, what can we expect to read from you in the future? Is there a new project or a set of questions that you're excited about?
Yeah, thank you. I think it won't surprise you from my research commitments, which I think we share some of these, that the things that I'm interested in are transnationality, mobilities in different sense of the word, people being moving around, but also social mobility, class mobility, tech and code work, but also tensions and productive tensions. How are differences made and remade in worlds where we might not necessarily think about differences, social differences? So currently I'm quite fascinated with the digital nomad phenomenon, in particular how Mexico City, other Latino locations, Colombia, even Puerto Rico, emerge as sites for digital nomads, especially from the US, especially with high Silicon Valley salaries, and how these nomads retreat to these closer locations. So they might first start out in Thailand, Asia, other parts of Asia, Japan, then they start getting tired for different reasons, retreat to these closer locations, but still want to maintain some sort of otherness in these locations where they end up. Mexico City is particularly interesting to think about this because there's other types of nomads brushing shoulders with these digital nomads, U.S. deportees, people who are raised in the U.S. and are deported for one reason or another, who are in a quite different position than the digital nomads, but there they are sharing space. Types of tensions emerge, something I'm quite interested in. I think it's going to form the basis of my next project and perhaps book.
Sounds fascinating. We look forward to it. Thank you so much, Hector, for this interview.
Thank you, Liliana. A pleasure to speak with you. And I also look forward and invite readers to read your work.
Oh, thanks.